Happy New Year from Tierney Talks. Hey, you're about to listen to a new episode with Beth Pickens. Beth Pickens is the author of Your Art Will Save Your Life, which is a book about making art during fascism, and it's basically an empowering, part therapeutic, part artistic experience that really pushes people to value their creative practice and the impact it has on your own life and other people's life, particularly during times of political upheaval or turmoil. Beth is a Los Angeles-based art consultant. She works with artists and arts organizations to implement new projects, to raise funding, to apply for grants, to reflect on past projects, and also to utilize their full context as a person in designing individual therapy for her clients. I hope this episode is sort of a way for you to cosplay like you're actually meeting with Beth herself, part counselor, part artist manager, full-time Capricorn, and a really amazing, intelligent person that makes me feel really supported. So please enjoy, listen to the end. Good morning, it's Tierney, and I'm here with Beth Pickens. It is, I think, the first day of Capricorn season, or at least very soon, which is very fitting. So welcome. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel both of our power growing.
Literally, we were just saying that, like, as soon as our astrological season hits, it just feels like, why is Capricorn energy so empowering?
It's so empowering, and just like, you can make anything happen. You just build it.
Build it. Sea goat. Step by step, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed lately in astrological, like, readings about Capricorns that I always knew that it was very, like, brick-by-brick approach to life, like, that we're very astute at building a life we want, but that, like, we're down to do the, like, piece-by-piece aspect of that. But lately I've been noticing that it's emphasizing that sometimes that can be slow.
And right. we're methodical, mm-hmm. and it's definitely tortoise in the hair. We are going to end up on top, but maybe nobody would anticipate that because we're going one brick at a time.
It's so,
building a solid foundation.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like I've been hearing too, like, oh, it feels like your career is beginning when you've been at it for 10 years. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it somehow resonated with me in the context of that Capricorn, like, kind of slow approach to getting what you want. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think I am, like, an ambitious person, but that the scope of what I'm really up to is probably still not realized to anyone but me, if that makes sense.
Right.
How do you resonate with being a Capricorn? Like, what do you like about that? Or is it the slow build?
I perhaps over-identify with being a Capricorn, like maybe too much, but I really resonate with and like the strong foundation, the dependability, that not just that others can depend on me, but that I know there's things about myself I can fully depend on. There's not a shaky thing inside of me. It feels very solid.
That's so good.
Yeah, and that just sort of the I'm very practical, and I like that about Capricorns. I like pragmatic things. I like lists. I like planning. I like not dreaming, but having an idea and then figuring out how to get there.
Right. It's just because it feels like that enables you to experience it even more fully.
Yeah.
I feel you. I think only recently I've been really taking stock of that idea of, like, showing up for yourself so much. And I think, you know, like most people, I'm very self-critical, or I feel a lot of the time that I haven't fully stepped into certain aspects of my own creativity or life that I'm really keen on and, like, have been waiting to or desperate for. But at the same time, taking stock of the last 10 years, because, you know, all the talk is about how the decade's ending and new decade's beginning. It's like, babe, I really showed up. Like, mm-hmm. so many sets, so many writing jobs, so many just such a variety of things, and even things beyond work. Just like, I work from home. I think we both work from home, right?
Right.
And just like how I never thought that, like, you know, less than, I mean, basically within 2 years out of college, 3 years, I was like a full-time work from home person. And I just never expected that. And you can't do that if you're not like going to show up for yourself and have that foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you like working from home?
I love working from home, particularly since living in Los Angeles, because for one thing, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to drive anywhere. And I love having authorship of my day. And I like that when I'm a good fast worker. So when I'm done with work, I can be done with work. And I never understood in workplaces sort of the ways people would seek to undermine one another, because I just thought, but aren't we all trying to get this thing done? And why wouldn't we all just want this thing to go well and go efficiently? And I can't have bosses.
Right.
So I have to be self-employed.
I feel like at work, I don't know if it's just because it's such a container of so much time when you're in a traditional office, but like, I think like that undermining comes from so much of that interpersonal, you know, the dynamics and like people's own conception of like themselves and self-worth. I feel like, I don't know, sometimes that was probably my own anxious projection, but a lot of the time I felt like I feel more supported by my colleagues when I don't spend every day with them.
Right. Well, in any contained environment of people will play out a family dynamic. That's just sort of this golden equation of people plus confined space plus time equals people play out a family dynamic. And I think I'm also not interested in that.
Literally, like, well, I mean, it's not the same thing, but I'm like, I love my work, you know, and I think you do too, but I don't think it's healthy to love your work more than your life. Like, I'm like, if you still love work more than life, like, you need to spruce up your life.
Exactly, exactly. That work should be supporting your life. It shouldn't be the center of your life. Even if it, you know, of course, work in American culture takes up most of our time.
Yeah.
And often we spend
number one, but maybe not in your heart.
Right. And we spend more time with the people we work with than with our loved ones often.
This is why I work alone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it's just like my life outside of work has to be really big. And it is. And I love my job. I invented it.
Totally. How does that feel? Like acknowledging that you really invented what you do.
It's amazing. I remember a long time ago, a friend described to me, she said, you know, you have a blue ocean strategy. And I was like, what's that? And it's a business term for people who just don't have any competition. But I had invented a thing without setting out to not have competition. I just put together two things that hadn't really gone together before and started this consulting business.
And those two things are therapy and kind of, or counseling and art.
Counseling and arts management.
Okay. And so that's how you describe what you do as a consultant. For listeners who haven't checked out your work, it's sort of bridging your experience in, yeah, like you said, art management and counseling to have these really kind of customized and intimate relationships with artists and arts organizations.
Right. When people ask me what I do, because I say arts consultant, but that is an empty phrase, I say I essentially help artists. I help them create a life that is meaningful to them, that prioritizes their art, and help them build the careers that they want and move their lives in the direction that they want.
And so cool. I mean, that kind of support is like everything. So to have a formalized like approach for people to like access is so cool.
It's amazing. And it's like the biggest honor for me, because I love artists. I love working with people. I love helping people. And artists to me are just, they're the most important people in my life. Because I need their work so badly.
Because art is making life better.
Yeah. It's so crucial to living for me and for so many other people that it feels like a symbiotic relationship.
Right. And I think if you even look at like all, not that I'm some aesthetics master, but just like if you look at all aesthetic history, like all of the philosophical, most of the philosophical like approaches to understanding art and criticism is like life is shit, art makes it better. So that's really good. When you say you've created this kind of path for yourself and this sort of open space in terms of where you're at in the market, like how long has that been happening? Like when did you launch your independent art consultant business?
I launched this back in 2010 in San Francisco.
Nice.
And it came to me. I didn't invent it and then build it. It sort of arrived to me because I was working in the arts in a variety of capacities, fundraising, managing director of different arts organizations, helping run an artist retreat. I helped found and run an artist retreat in the Yucatan in Mexico for 5 years. And the first year at that retreat, listening to all the artists talk about the things that were making them crazy and making them feel bad and the things they were confused about living and being an artist and building a career, it just... I thought, my God, I was trained to be a therapist. Like, I could help them. I know how to answer their questions. So at that first year at the retreat, I offered to the artists there, if you would like to sit down and just have a formal conversation about what's going on with you professionally, creatively, interpersonally, then I can talk you through some of those things. And in that moment, I realized, oh, I could do this for artists. This could be – I had many freelance jobs, but I thought this could be kind of a side hustle where I can be of service to some artists using my counseling background, using my career building knowledge, using my fundraising knowledge. I could do this for this very specific population of people that I love.
And your passion and know all about art, you know, curiosity. It's so cool. And like, what is a kind of intake session like with you? Like,
it's really cool.
It must be so satisfying to listen.
It's a 2-hour session. And during that session, I ask my new client to take me as far back on their family as they know on every side. So we excavate all of the generations that came before them. And they sort of paint me a picture of who are the families and in the backstories of them. In particular, who and where are they? What was their level of education? What did they do for work, whether paid or unpaid? What was their class level? What were their attitudes and expectations about these parts of life? So we comb through all of the family history, and then we move into the artist's life, starting with when they're a little kid, and follow them up through their family of origin, their experience of school, how and why they left home, under what conditions, how they started out as a young adult, all the way to the present. And so that gives me just a really rich understanding of who socialized them, with what beliefs and attitudes, what perceived choices, how they made decisions, sort of what their narrative of it all has been. Mm-hmm. And that gives me a lot of information of where we can go next.
I'm sure I see this happen in sort of like acting class, for example, with my teacher's like 88 years old. And so he'll have people speak. And it's just always impressive to me how trained folks can just listen to people for like, whether it's 10 minutes or 2 hours, a brief amount of time compared to their years living, and get like a really vivid sketch of not just who they are, like in terms of a list of attributes, but like a true sense of how they react or how they respond to the world around them. It's really interesting.
The words they use, how they talk about it, their emotions that come up as they're describing their family and their life. And what I find that's really helpful, because my thinking is when I'm starting with a new artist, if I just said, so, you know, tell me about your art, I feel like I would get this very stilted, sort of cold, detached, removed talk.
Gallery description.
Yeah, of what they've been trained or what they think they're supposed to be. But if we start off with them telling me about who their grandmothers were,
right,
then by the time we get to them as an adult, they've sort of relaxed into themselves. And so it's sort of an easier entree into now them as an adult and thinking about their lives as an artist.
So cool. I love that. Yeah, I think it's so interesting how that early life experience and attitudes come, you know, just how you said how even in work environments or in any group of people that's contained over time, that like family dynamics emerge. I just, no wonder everyone's obsessed or avoidant of family.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's the foundation of group psychology that when you just have a group of people, people will inevitably start to play out family roles.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like I kind of mentioned to you before, it's an interesting family dynamic in my own experience because I'm an only child from LA, but my mom is the middle of 9, all from LA. And then my dad is younger side of six, I guess. But it's just interesting, like the mythology of different parts of your family. You know, my mom's family is like a Hollywood family, moved to LA from New York when the Pictures moved from New York to LA.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, rich during the Depression off movies and like so much excess and luxury and tight-knitness, and the way that those all conflate with each other or like combine is like the mythology, you know. But also there was a lot of like when you have a family that's so rich in history and has all these amazing like you know, Hollywood people and athletes and like characters that emerge, it's like everyone is so obsessed with each other, and there's definitely a confidence and strength and like pride to that. But there's also this psychology of like, since the time I'm born, it's like I've basically missed the golden era kind of thing.
Like something has passed.
Yeah, like because they didn't have money at the end. Mm. You know, like kind of if you spoil 9 kids that richly, then it makes sense how it couldn't last forever kind of thing. And just not the I don't know, like how – yeah, just one – I'm curious how all this kind of plays out, or like having another side of the family that just lacks that kind of narrative power as one side. It doesn't mean that I don't love those people or think they're impacting my life or creativity. It's just like the way that we get told stories can be vastly different from one side to the other.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I tell my clients when they come in for that first session, it doesn't even actually matter what the facts are. It matters what story you believe to be true.
And what you
because
pick.
That's so true about families too.
Oh, because like my mom has 9 siblings, but you can probably get only 3 or 4. You know, they're coupled up into matching belief systems, but different renditions of like what happened, you know?
Well, it said every sibling has different parents, right? Because every sibling in that family had a different experience of the family.
It's so cool. I know. I always am curious like what my life would be like with siblings too. I feel like only – I can't even imagine. I feel like my family dynamic with my parents itself is pretty unique and beautiful and wacky. And it's very hard for me to imagine who another person would have been in that dynamic.
Right.
I guess we'll never know, thank God. What was your childhood like?
My childhood was sad. I had parents who were very limited and had children very young. My mom was 16 when she became pregnant with my older brother, who he died a few years ago. And my father was very young. They were teenagers when they had their first kid. They were in their early 20s when I was born, and probably not very well suited for each other.
Yeah.
And they divorced when I was 13. And my mom has mental illness. My father is an alcoholic. And I was growing up in this environment that just I couldn't find a lot. I couldn't find a lot to reflect me back at me. Mm-hmm. And my parents were just unavailable for that.
Yeah.
And my older brother had a lot of he had what would now probably be diagnosed as oppositional defiant disorder, missing school, hurting animals, setting fires, that kind of stuff,
yeah.
Starting from a really young age.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of behavioral problems. And so my home was very chaotic or lonely.
Right.
There was either a sort of turmoil and conflict or just maybe I'd just be alone.
So much going on around you that you're kind of finding – like what did you end up finding yourself in, or like what did reflect back to you when during that kind of lonely experience?
School. Definitely school because it was structure.
Achievement.
I was a very good student. I loved to please my teachers, and so my teachers would really like me. Yeah, and they could reflect me back at me, and
nice.
I read a lot. I still read a lot. Reading is like a lifetime major hobby in my life.
I love that. What were your favorite – do you remember any of your favorite books as a kid?
When I was a kid, it was all about Babysitter's Club
because
they were business women.
Entrepreneurs, Capricorn, big Capricorn
energy.
They
were business women.
I just watched the Babysitter's Club movie, which is nowhere near as good as the books, but I was just happy to return to that world. I know Don.
I know Christy. Them so intimately. I remember as a kid, I would dream about them.
Claudia, oh my God, it's so cool. Claudia loves junk food.
I can't spell anything.
Yeah.
So I loved Babysitter's Club.
That's awesome. And I like this aspect of – you talk a lot about mentorship in your books and just in life, but you kind of tell a cute story about visiting an exhibit with maybe a neighbor who knew you could probably use the art in your life or that you would enjoy the experience. Will you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I had this neighbor who lived down the street from me, and she was an artist and an art teacher, I think in like middle school or junior high. She was not my art teacher, but in another school district. And she had a newsletter called The Moose Letter that was for people around the world who collected cow paraphernalia.
Oh my God, and it was just your neighbor and your
Yes, and that's how my mom met her, because my mom got this zine and then realized that this the woman putting out this publication lived in our tiny town of 2,000 people outside of Pittsburgh, which is so, I mean, all of this now I'm like, oh, this was like God or the universe bringing someone to me. And this woman was so cool. Very few people in my life, very few adults went to college. She'd gone to college. Mm-hmm. She went to the Peace Corps in Brazil in the 60s.
Amazing.
She was just this really cool woman. No kids.
Cool, artsy lady.
So, so cool. And she, I can't remember who first introduced it to me, but she said, you know, this museum's opening, the Andy Warhol Museum, who I'd vaguely heard of him. I knew he was from Pittsburgh.
Excuse me. That's cool.
And she said, we're going to... this thing's happening and it's really exciting. And so I think I was in ninth grade. And so in my speech class, I wrote, I did a speech all about Andy Warhol and that this museum was opening, which seemed so inconceivable that whatever this cool thing was happening, that it was happening in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
It just seemed unbelievable.
Totally.
And so I got very wrapped up in it. She and I made an art piece together, like a portrait of Andy Warhol. It's in my kitchen now in Los Angeles. Aww. And so she took me to the opening in 1994 or five. I can't remember which now. And it was at midnight. The place opened at midnight. And so I wore cool. like a weird polyester thrifted dress. And,
yes.
And she picked me up at like 11:30.
You got to go out. You had to go out to this
museum opening. And now I have since, as an adult, looked back and like John Waters was there and all these club kids were there. I didn't know who any of these people were.
It was actually sick. Yeah.
Yeah, because this was pre-internet. So I had no way of knowing any of this stuff.
I just happened to look at any of them.
I just got to be there. But while I was there, I saw all these freaks, like all these queer freaks. And I was like, oh, my God, these people exist.
You had never seen that.
Never had seen it, except in, you know.
Maybe a film or two.
In movies or references in books or, like, weird publications I would find or bands that would come to town.
Yeah.
But because there was no internet, I didn't know how to find my people. And so I just saw all these weird freaks, and I thought, I just have to get out of here and go to wherever they are. I just have to go follow the freaks. And that museum opening was so transformative because I saw these people and we combed every floor of the museum so carefully and talked about all of the art. And it just – I mean, for one thing, it cemented a lifelong love of Andy Warhol and mm-hmm. obsession about his life and all of the mythology that came out of his lifetime and his peers and colleagues in the factory. But also just like it put me on this path of understanding – there was culture I had to go find that I might not know how to find it, but they were out there.
It doesn't mean that it's not there.
Exactly.
And it doesn't mean that your house is all there is. Because I feel as a kid, that's what it feels like, right? Because like
you only have access to what's around you, especially before the internet. There was just the people around me. And I realized like, okay, so there's going to be people I'm maybe more interested in. I just have to go find them.
And especially it just seems unique to have that experience in like an institutional context like a museum opening, because it's also sort of like bolstered or it feels even more like amazing to like have access to this group of like queer freaks when they're also being like celebrated as a community that this artist is like shepherding, you know.
Right.
It was like, it's super sick to stumble upon community at a bar too, but like it feels special that it was given
it's a
this
thing I could
exhibition
go to
space
over and over.
Yeah, and there was resources and intellect around it and, like, you know, thought community is cool. Yeah, I feel like Warhol is somebody that, I don't know, I find his life super interesting. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, like, if you're a creative person, like, I'm going to be 28 on the 28th. So, like, I mean, there's just, like, no way if you're, like, a young artist of any age that you're not going to have some interest in what Warhol is at some point. But I feel like like the time I'm growing up, it was probably so put on me that when I got a little older, I felt like maybe it was like embarrassing to like be interested in Andy Warhol. But that's stupid. You know, it's like a judgment of curiosity because I was literally curious and a fan. But yeah, I guess I just bring that up to talk about like the way that an artist's like legacy like stays the same or changes over time, you know?
Yeah. Well, definitely. The Warhol Foundation and his estate, certainly as you were growing up, the commercialization of his imagery became so pervasive.
Exactly.
That didn't exist, I would say, probably before that museum opened. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't like go to a store and buy something that had a Warhol image on it in the 90s.
And you weren't scrolling the internet and seeing everybody that you went to like a class with in a shirt.
Because there was no internet.
Yeah. No wonder you were lonely.
Yeah. It was a very different time for queer people to come up.
Yeah.
My wife and I talk about this all the time because she's she's older than me. She's 8 years older than me. And the generational, the very swift intergenerational differences over the past 50 years for queer people is wild. It's a wild ride.
Right.
And so she works in a writer's room right now where there's queer people in their early and mid 20s, and they came up in a completely different world than she did in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. where she was describing last night, for example, that it was totally a valid thought for queer people her age that when they realized they were gay or queer or trans, the first thought was, okay, I guess I should kill myself.
Yeah.
And that might not – it may still be true for many, but that might not be the pervasive experience of people now who realize they're queer.
It feels at least like easy to say that it's not as frequent as it would have been, you know.
When that would just be the standard response.
Yeah, because even someone who I'm editing, she's queer and she's also does porn. And she was just saying like how porn was the best thing, like for her to be able to see like other black femmes like having sex was the most empowering thing for her. And she's a little bit older than me too. She's probably 40 or almost 40. She was like, I felt like I was sick and like fucked up and like, it's not to say that's the same as suicidal, but just feeling very wrong.
Right.
I feel like maybe queer people, especially in America coming out today, like they might have a lot. There's might be anxiety and tension and rife conflict, but perhaps not as immediate, like canceled from society,
right?
You know, doomed deserve to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you are coming up in a miserable family that cannot, that can't love you through that experience, you can see in the culture more immediately around you that there are other people like you, like you're mm-hmm. not alone. And that's, you know, one of the things about the digital age is it's so interesting because there's this duality of, I find that people are more isolated in the digital age.
Yeah.
But they are more connected and know they're not alone.
Right.
Both are happening at the same time.
They're alone but feeling better. Yeah.
They're lonely but not alone.
Right. Because I think about it with friends and family that's younger than me who it seems like their like foundation or like ethos, like the way that they have that mirrored to them through their feeds basically, it feels more – inclusive and like just more like emotionally resonant and politically astute and like, you know, cooler, smarter, right, in terms of like what they experience every day as a 15-year-old than what I experience every day as a 15-year-old in terms of the dominant culture. Because like that stuff on Instagram now, or let's say, it's like it is kind of mainstream, you know, to be like you know, politically aware on Instagram or like a feminist on Instagram, whereas like I felt, yeah, like I didn't have that, right? I didn't have that like media awareness or reflectiveness. But when I had that through friendships or through Misbehave magazine or through my, you know, humanities education, like when I did feel that, it was like really real. Like it was like I really experienced it. And like it's a long way of saying it, but I feel like a lot of the youth who they're mentally engaged with like better ideas than ever or whatever, you know, more progressive ideas, that like they're kind of not actually ever experiencing them. Or like, I feel like that's why I love programming and like talks and stuff, because I'm realizing now that like a lot of people who like love intersectional feminist discourse have never been in a room full of intersectional feminists,
right,
or who
right.
haven't, you know, had that opportunity.
Right. Or never read any of the early work of the woman who coined the term. And
yeah.
Yeah. I had to come to feminism in college through women's and gender studies, never even hearing the word feminist, just knowing that. Learning that there was language to describe how I felt and my orientation in the world
yeah.
was so incredible. And I think that language is definitely sort of more culturally mandated through social media and available to people. So it's sort of like they can pick up the identities without ever having learned the things.
Right.
And maybe it previously was you would learn or have the sense, these intuitions, but not know there was words for it. And maybe
right.
not sort of
that's
the flip.
A really interesting flip. Yeah, I definitely resonate with that happening. I feel, yeah, I don't know, feminist, because it's not like your mom was, she wasn't calling herself a feminist, was
Absolutely
she?
Absolutely not, but there were so many feminist things about her, but she
totally.
Wasn't, I don't even know if she would have known really what it meant when
right.
I was growing up. She didn't have the things I had access to just in terms of education.
Totally.
But yeah, so it's like we grow up around these things, but maybe people aren't using the words.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew, like, there was a queerness to me, but I didn't have the language for it.
Right.
Until I was introduced to the language. So what happens now if you're introduced to the language, you're not even sure what it means?
Yeah, but you know you should say it. Or you feel right. socially responsible.
Yeah, like I have to be the thing.
Yeah.
But even when I was in, certainly when I was an undergrad, being a feminist and being queer definitely put me in the very small population, right. not in the representative, not in the popular representation.
Or not like a go off, thumbs
yeah.
up.
Those, you know? Yeah, absolutely not. Those were not but benefits.
I think we can, I don't know, there's just so many iterations of that. Like, I don't know, even definitely queerness. Like, I was very like, I'm queer in high school, but I was in a very liberal environment. But then once I got to call and I had, we were taught very explicitly, like podcast listeners are probably sick of me talking about high school like a fucking loser, but like, you know, very intricate gender, race, class, discourse. And then like I went to a conservative Jesuit college that hosted the debate last night that literally someone put up like Trump 2020 under the letters of the college. And I was like really feeling like, oh, if you wondered why I fucking hated it here, basically, you know, like, so it was just interesting to like have had that language, but then to, it was kind of like a flip in its own, you know, feel like most people feel like you're in a conservative environment and then you like get the language and find yourself in a more, feminist or queer, politicized environment. And I kind of felt the opposite, which I'm glad that I have experienced both, you know, but it's cool. So, you're from the Rust Belt, like Andy Warhol.
Deep Rust Belt, yeah. I mean, Andy was from an impoverished Polish immigrant family. And, I'm deep Rust Belt.
What do you think you, love the most about his overall, like, artistic history or just, like, how he became what he became?
I don't know. Do you remember that there was this tweet floating around a couple weeks ago that was really funny and resonant with a lot of people, so everyone's reposting it, but it was like, every time I meet someone who I think is super successful in New York, I find out their grandfather owned the railroad.
Right.
And I just thought they were really hardworking yes. and smart. And something I love about Andy Warhol is he had nothing. You know, he really had nothing. He had his talent and his ambition and his drive and his desire to get out of Pittsburgh. And that's what he had.
It's so cool.
His grandfather didn't have anything. His parents didn't have anything.
Right.
And so I love that he built this thing. And we have this bootstraps mythology in the U.S. that has to be critical. We have to look at it critically all the time. And here was a person who – he didn't have anything. He was a Polish immigrant in the 40s in Pittsburgh. He was not set up for success.
Yeah.
And so I love that about him, that he truly came from nothing and decided he wanted something different from himself and was such a freak. And yet he was beloved. His family loved him. He was loved in his schools. But he had this instinct that he followed. They had to get out and find something else, which I really relate to. And I also love that he was such a businessman. Like I think it's a great joke that I would wander around the Warhol Museum, and one of my favorite pieces was called Oxidations, and it was this piece that was all these materials that somebody urinated on, which made these crazy splashes all over it. And I always thought, God, I would love when I was a teenager, I would play if I could have any piece in this room, what would I take? And I would pick an oxidation piece. And I used to think, because maybe that's Andy Warhol's urine, and then I'd have like a piece of him. Uh-huh. But then as I got older, understanding like, oh no, he wasn't even making his art.
Right.
He was doing so many other things. He had 25 other people making his work. And just to see how he created the machinery of it all and saw the capitalism of art and both loved it and was winking at it and making fun of it at the same time. I love that about him because I'm obsessed with money too. And thinking about like, what does it mean? What is this resource? What can you do with it? What do we project onto it?
And so, how can we get it?
How do we get it? Yeah, I mean, that's something I talk about with my clients all the time. So I love that about Warhol.
That's super beautiful. And yeah, I love that too. I feel like that joke you said about the, oh, you find out who someone's family is or where they come from. It's just like lately when I'm doing a new deal or something, or, you know, like a new little project, I'm like, I'm calling my rich friend. Like my friend who's been rich and who probably doesn't even realize how rich she is because of generational wealth and like – how rich other people they know are, you know what I mean? But it's like, I asked you, oh, was your mom a feminist? Kind of knowing, you know, like my mom also definitely didn't have the language of feminism, even though she's
doing feminism.
Super independent, ballsy, no bullshit, like union organizer, cool ass lady. But like, I would kind of mock her, be like, you were around. You didn't even choose to be a feminist. You were too busy getting high. Like, you know, like, why didn't you engage? But there is some – if I'm thinking critically about, like, my story as an artist and, like, my childhood and how some of that comes up, like, it was very central to me that, like, my dad is, like, very much so an artist, but just, like, that they didn't – neither of them went to college. Neither – my mom grew up super wealthy but then didn't have money really and then married my dad who definitely didn't have money and kind of – be, you know, entered definitely different working class life that she's still in. And it's just really curious to see, like, how people can make something of themselves when they felt so other. Mm-hmm. Like, I think not that, like, obviously, like, Andy Warhol did not feel included in so many of these institutions, including capitalism, that he ended up, like, owning, you know? Mm-hmm. And not to equate myself with that, but just, like, I think a less talked about but really impactful part of my creative history is just how ambitious I always was. And, like, I had so much fear, even though I have such a loving and fun and creative parents and home, and I spend, like, all the time with them, literally. But, like, I just was, like, so afraid that my parents' life was going to determine mine. And now I can see the ways that it does that are so beautiful or funny or crucial to who I am. But, like, I was just so scared all the time that, like, I wouldn't get something because my parents don't know about art, my parents don't know about college, no one helps me with shit, you know, they will right. do anything for me, but right. no one knows what this form is, no one knows anyone right. who, none of their friends are,
they can't call in a favor exactly. for you, they can't, I'm not interning with their
fucking
right.
stoner plumber friend, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And I think as I'm a writer and, like, comedian, like, I have so much love for, people will always tell me, like, you're so grounded. I'm like, okay, like, sometimes I'm like, no, I'm not, I'm fucking fancy. Like, what does that mean, you know? But it's just interesting, the plane of, like, feeling so down to earth that you're scared you'll never be able to rise up in terms of, like, money, status, opportunity, creativity. But then also, in many ways, I have had very rarefied experiences and really beautiful opportunities. And so then to also be like, actually, I love people like that, like, not needing to really be with, like, upper echelon of institutional art world to feel like wanting to avoid that a lot of the time. So yeah, so it's so weird. Like, I so many, like, when there's, like, a true art family, I'm like, what are you all like?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my work has given me so much compassion, empathy, and understanding of people who come from contexts that me, before doing this job, would have made so many assumptions about, too, right? Mm-hmm. It's really softened me to understand what happens in these families where there's these boom and bust generations, where there's wealth, and then there's nothing, and then there's people trying to resurrect it. And what happens when people come from a ton of economic privilege, and they feel ashamed, and, like, they can't tell anybody. It's a secret. They have to keep. Uh-huh. There's so many different. We all just come from our context,
right?
And they all fuck us up. It doesn't matter. Who you are, right? And so I love getting to hear everybody's backstory and how they make sense of it. And I just want to know that about every single person, which is why I feel right. like I've landed the lottery with my job, where I get to hear the financial backstory of everybody and it's how so cool. their family generations worked. And I just love those stories because you can see how they impact our choices and what we perceive as available to us. And then how do we react and change from that as we grow older?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so just inspired by what you say. Like, it's just giving me threads to think about because, like, even what you already said, like, I'm totally the one that's, like, I've literally probably said it out loud. Like, I'm the one that can resurrect, like, money and Hollywood glory. And, like, perhaps, like, my cousins, even who I'm really close to, would be surprised that I even think like that. Mm. Or, like, that's some deep part of me really feels that, though. Like, I feel so connected to my grandfather in particular.
Mm, this
and so,
legacy.
Like, I'm proud, you know? Like, I could cry, right? Like, I love that. So it's not all about the, like, money of it all. But also it probably is because, yeah, I want money. Like you said, I love money. And, like, I do, you know, I want to talk about, like, being, like, you know, whether it's, like, just being a compassionate person or, like, being a feminist, being queer feminist artist. Like, I feel a lot of time when these identities are paired together, which obviously they so often are in our communities, like, that there is sort of – sometimes I think shitty business happens because people are, like, utilizing, like, money avoidant fear. Like it's kind of like, this is a queer feminist production. So like,
no one's getting paid.
Yeah. And that right. we're supposed
That's
to
not
like,
feminist.
Yeah. And that we're supposed to feel like, okay about that. Right. And like, I've had really weird, I feel like so many like celebrity feminists have like exploited me and yeah. like, but also the more,
oh, yes.
I'm not surprised by that. And that's a lot in the past too. I'm more surprised by like the low key community type friends and femmes who like think that like, it, I don't know. I feel a lot of shame about wanting money. I felt a lot of shame about being ambitious. Mm-hmm. I think that I spent the time since I got out of college, until really like this year, trying to minimize the extent of my ambition, to minimize the extent of what I think I'm really capable of or what I really want. And I'm like, why? Because I'm afraid to. It's just interesting to have a little reflectiveness towards that and be like, what am I afraid of? Wanting money? Everyone fucking wants money, right, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Do you think that comes up? Like, or do some people, is there something about like wanting to get away from like the exploitiveness of certain capitalist systems that like can make queer people feel weird about wanting money or getting rich?
And how? Oh, does it? It comes up for probably all of my clients. I wrote about this in my next book in my money chapter. Mm-hmm. I referenced this one particular kind of money damage that's written about in the lesbian lexicon. It's called punk damage.
Yes.
And that is the sort of community enforced feeling that money is bad and to want it is immoral and nothing about money can be positive. And a lot of people get, for not everybody's part of a punk community, but often they'll say like, oh yeah, in the place I grew up in or came of age in, we had that too, even if we weren't punk. But this kind of money damage that money is bad, to want it is bad, to ask for it is wrong, that it's inherently immoral and dirty and bad. And unlearning all of that stuff, because money is just a resource that we project meaning onto. And often to truly believe money is bad, you probably didn't come from a situation where there wasn't any. I don't know people who come from poor and working class families who think money is bad because they know what happens when there isn't any.
Right. Like I, you know, definitely Bernie 2020, like I'm all for socialism, but like in high school and like early college, like all of my most outspoken socialist friends would be like, you have a trust fund, fuck right. off.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I think you can be really critical of money as a young person when you have knowledge of a net.
Yes.
And when there is no net, there instead of that, in replace of a net is sometimes fear. Just fear of not being able to take care of yourself or your family.
Yes. And I would be so anxious and angry.
Yeah.
And I would be berating to my parents and like really mean because I felt so fearful.
Well, and growing up in LA, I grew up around people where the richest people were like their parents were both teachers. But growing up in Los Angeles, where it's like you're seeing extreme poverty to the biggest wealth in the country.
All at once.
All at the same time.
You know, all in the same day, especially because I was like very suburban schoolgirl, but also very Hollywood party girl. And you know what's interesting about the culture of money in LA, just something I thought about recently, is that even though I would go to school with like so many just like first generation kids, so many people who didn't have money at all, you know, at a huge public school, but also I did have a lot of like European heiressy friends who we met on Hollywood Boulevard and started partying with at hotels and like bottle service and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of, and people from LA like that too. And I felt, even though LA money can be so annoying too, I felt like until I went to college and experienced just like upper middle class, or like, it's not upper middle class, it's wealthy, but like, it was almost like the LA of it all, the Hollywood of it all, had a little bit more flexibility where even though there was very clear money differences in terms of what people wore and who they were, and I masked myself, like I covered myself in like glitter every day basically just to like feel like I could be weird but cooler than it all. It's just weird how there was more money in my life around me as a teen that I wasn't as insecure about until I experienced the like super norm culture, conservative family wealth.
Right.
Yeah, the Catholic family wealth was like way more. Like people at my college were like landing their jet, you know,
right
on campus.
And that's such a mind fuck for a person who's learning to understand economics. I grew up in a you know, financially homogenous area where most people were in the same range. Right. And in Los Angeles, even before the internet, there's no way you wouldn't be exposed to there is poverty and there is extreme wealth. It's just the nature of this place.
It's interesting.
Yeah. But so money damage is a major thing I have to work on with all of my clients because so many of them have it.
What's another type of money damage? Is there like punk damage? Is that like a subsection?
I think it's a subsection of money damage. I mean, there's definitely money damage related to being socialized as female. If you spent any or all of your time being socialized as a girl or a woman in this culture, then you have, whether you wanted to or not, you have you've made interior beliefs about your worth and what kind of labor you should be providing. Definitely feminist money damage, right? Like it should all be free. No one should get paid, which is absurd. That's not the end goal of feminism.
Yeah.
It's the economic prosperity for all, that we everybody rises up, not that everybody just collapses and can't take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you mentioned about sort of being exploited by economically powerful feminists, that is a trend that I've seen in Los Angeles since I've moved here. I'm sure it exists everywhere, but I've definitely seen it here, where the message of feminism is through the media and then the internal workings are abysmal.
And I even felt kind of shameful to bring it, like right after I said it, which is, it's so, isn't it so explicitly relevant to what we're talking about, but like I still felt a twinge of shame of like, oh, I don't want to seem ungrateful or, you know, all this
that's female socialization. Yeah, that is like, the socialization.
Embarrassed that these wealthy people, not, I mean, who knows? They're not fucking listening. Maybe they are like, they would love me to be making their podcast, but like, just saying like, it's like, to acknowledge that you don't have as much resources. Like, I did a lot of appearance keeping growing up. Mm. I never let people know I didn't have money. I would still think most people who follow me or who fuck with me probably think that I have much more money than I do.
Right.
But I kind of have minimized the class conversation because of whiteness and because I know that I have a lot of opportunity. So I just – not because I don't think you can be white and have, like, a – be poor, but I just think that sometimes, like, especially post Trump, that like there's so much like white virtue signaling to like target identity. You know, it's like I try not to even talk about being queer because I'm like, I have a fucking boyfriend. Like, I don't need to be like, you know, just like all these different things where I try not to take up space in certain ways. But there's something about the class part that like I'm passionate about exposing more because I want people who like what I make or who like what I talk about to know that like I've only been scared of money my whole life basically, and maybe in the last couple of years I've done a lot more intentional work to aid some of the money damage, but like it's definitely, I've had some crazy financial habits. It's ongoing.
And you're not alone. I think financial transparency about our behaviors, beliefs, attitudes, about the reality of it, about how money works and who's getting paid what and the background structures, the more financial transparency in every level of the economy, our individual economies around our communities and the economic climate we live in, is how that is one of the things that erodes punk damage, money damage.
Yes.
It's just more transparency talking about money, which is what I love to do.
Instead of rejecting it.
And yeah.
Right? Margo wants money. I need to pay her. I'm a feminist exploiting you.
No.
But isn't it interesting because like what you do, you offer such personalized and potentially empowering and transformative and healing service to artists. But like that whole like queer, like punk shame around money, like it could, you wouldn't be able to have this interesting career you've built from yourself if you thought that as like a queer woman who's in the arts and has all these relationships with artists, if you thought that you never deserved to charge any of them, then you couldn't make money doing what you do. You know?
It's just not sustainable. I mean, people would stop making their work because they would become demoralized and just logistically not be able to do it anymore. But so money is one of the main things I bring up for all my clients. The first piece of homework they get at the end of our intake session is they have a writing prompt, and they have to think about and write about their lives in looking through a few different lenses, and one of them is finance.
And you also tell us a little bit about Getting Real with Money. I don't know if that's something you're ongoingly producing, but tell us about it.
I'll probably do it in 2020. It's a two-part workshop I do. because I'm really passionate about helping artists and anybody really, but it's usually artists and a lot of creative people who come to the workshop, where we spend time unearthing our behavioral and emotional and psychological relationship to money and doing financial literacy and goal making at the same time. Because to me, making financial change is about two pools of work that are equally important, but they're different, but they have to happen at the same time. One is math and financial literacy, like learning about managing money, actually learning the nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
And the other one is learning about your specific behavioral, emotional, and psychological relationship to it. And if we don't address that, the other thing will never happen.
Yeah.
And I learned that when I would try to that side. Yeah, because I learned that if I tried to teach – I learned this from teaching grant writing, that if I didn't first help people become aware of what it was like for them to think about money and asking for things, then it didn't – I could teach them all the skill building in the world, but they'd be sitting there having a panic attack and they couldn't absorb any of it. And it's the same thing with money. Like first we have to get grounded in your body, your history, your experience. And I open it with a guided meditation. We have to – and when we learn when you identify what goes on for you, then how to navigate it. Right. So like becoming aware, learning how to navigate, and then learning about personal finance and making changes and goals and behavioral adaptations that are very specific for your context.
For you.
Not what a person should do, but what you are going
to
do.
Because like I don't relate a lot to I try to like look at little money, you know, when these grabby headlines intended to lure people in just like me about financial literacy, or especially for women or for emerging creatives or emerging young girl bosses like me.
Right.
It's like when I check out the tips, I mean, bro, I could tell you them right now. You know, like it's right. so
yeah
unspecific. It's just so like
– it's assumptive.
Yes,
it presumes a lot
it's
about you.
So much, and it's like
it can't meet you
I'm
where
not
you're
cooking
at.
Anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so at the end of that workshop, or actually the end of day one, I give everybody a worksheet where they have to pick a bunch of different resources about financial literacy and try a couple. Because I think really what a person has to do is hear from a range of voices and identify what they're willing
pick
to do,
those
not what they should do.
Or options.
But yeah, because like the financial changes that will work for you are the ones you'll do, not the ones that you should be doing, but
right.
like the things you will actually do right now.
And to honor that that's better than not doing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like right now I have student debt and like it's not – I mean I got basically almost a full scholarship into school. But I just kind of took out loans of life. Like, I don't know. Like, some of it went to school, but it was, like, probably around $30,000 of debt or a little more. That's now, like, almost 40 or a little within that range, 30 to 40. Once again, yeah, clearly don't even know the number. And I honestly just didn't pay my student loans for, like, I don't know, years, I guess. And there's just something about not coming from money or having financial literacy that makes you feel like a criminal.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I've really worked on that. And, like, when the mail comes, I don't get scared. But it's, like, you would have – for the type of, like, fear, anxiety I've had about certain bills and money and stuff over the years, you would think that I've been committing crimes.
Right.
And it's, like – I still feel awkward to even say that out loud, but it's like, well, I wasn't. I haven't, you know, like.
No, you just took out loans like the majority of Americans who go to college.
Right. And just how, like.
It's the number two debt.
Yeah. Having that kind of support around, like, no one even knows. Imagine, like, we just don't learn anything about money management, I feel
it's
like.
It's absolutely true. We don't. And so as adults, we get to, and we get to find the voices that we resonate with. Like maybe you don't want to learn financial literacy from a man or from a white person. Maybe you need to find someone who you can relate to and you can
right.
even hear. And that's crucial.
And if, yeah, like is there, if you think about your own experience, is there one like behavior or way of thinking about money that you've like adapted as you've come of age and like thought about all this stuff that you think has been the most transformative?
Yes. And I can tell you the most transformative thing for me has been to imagine myself as an older person and to imagine that what I do now that's hard or uncomfortable, it's for her. It's so
that's
I can
really
take
cool.
care of her.
Yeah,
it's all for her.
That's so nice. Yeah, it's interesting. I looked at a budget I made for a project like in maybe 2014, and it was me and my best friend directing as a pair. And I listed directors, like one fee for the both of us, already weird, not thinking I deserved. You know, I made a lot of work with my, I mean, really like gender fluid, but male, you know, best friend. And, like, so much was just presumed that wasn't mine kind of thing. So it just makes total sense that we wouldn't be like, boom, boom. I don't know. Just, like, that's all me in a weird way. Like, catering to, like, what I expected from people we were working with. But the fee was, like, $500 for the both of us to share. So I'm like, wow, we made, like, it was for, like, I don't want to say the label, but it was, like, basically the hugest record label. I'm like, what? We thought we each deserved $250.
Right.
And I bring it up just in the context of age because it's, like, you know, a few years out of that, it's, like, thinking about me and what I deserve and my needs just, like, in this body. But, yes, in future ones, I wouldn't believe I deserved that, you know?
Right. Yeah, but that's, like, the best she could do, right?
Right.
When you were younger, that's the best she could do. And that's amazing. You asked for something.
It was awkward then.
You know? Asked for something then. You didn't say, no, do it for free, right? Like, right. You did the best you could, and it was still pretty great. And now you do something different.
Better, yeah. And, yeah, being compassionate about all that, for sure. And, like, how do you – because, you know – I think we're going to be listening to this in 2020, and I'm sure that every single person listening would prefer to earn more money in this new year than we did last year. What is a tip you have for, like, I know it's so broad and not specific, mm-hmm. but for just, like, raising your rates or getting your money up?
Yeah. I mean, the very first thing is just assessing, okay, how do you currently make money, and how can you ask for more? Whether mm-hmm. it's asking for a raise at your job where you're employed or raising the rates for the goods or services that you offer, that's standard because the cost of living goes up every year, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing about you being greedy or you're trying to make a profit. No, this is the standard of living goes up. Most
right.
jobs are supposed to give a COLA, a cost of living increase, and many don't.
Right.
So if we're not raising our rates every year slightly, if we're not going up with an increased cost of living, we're setting ourselves up for economic failure.
That is so interesting because, like, you know, I was offered a rate in, like, 2014. I'm, like, what, 22 years old or something, like, senior editor job, day rate. Thought it was so high. Thought it was so high. And then I'm not working with that client full time anymore, you know, but it's still an option. And, like, my rate is the same. And that's, it's like, it's fine, but it's just funny because it was generous at the time. But it was just funny that I thought it was a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just interesting right. how it's like something can be a lot. But then 4 years later, when you actually know how to do the job that you were hired
right.
to do.
Well, and 4 years later when gas has gone up a dollar and your rent may have gone up $300, you know, it's
totally.
Just cost of life goes up. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I would say, the best piece of advice I ever got about how to ask for money or rather how to come up with a price is as much money as you can say with a straight face.
Such good advice. I definitely experimented with asking for more than I was comfortable with, but that I could say with a straight face recently. And it just felt so good. And it's basically locked, like, I'm, you know, like, I want to say, like, and it's worked out, you know, but it's, like, one of those things where I have a fee, but then there's also a budget attached to the project, so that's still being talked about a little bit, and I do have that kind of feminine socialized shame around not changing my rate as the project budget fluctuates, but it's, like, no, you know, I'm not going to, but, yeah, so talking about that vision of your older self and what they deserve and what you're working for. Now, something my friend Andrea Young, who's a hypnotherapist, mentions to me, and she does a lot of artist coaching as well using hypno, and she was like, listen, I was kind of saying, you know, I think it was earlier this year, I was talking about believing that I deserved an increase in a day rate on a certain project. And I was like, I feel really uncomfortable to, like, say it. I feel like, you know, my fear is that they're like, wow, what an entitled bitch she is. She thinks she's so good or whatever. And she was like, listen, just because you live cheaply doesn't mean that you don't deserve equitable payment. Like, she's like, you are doing the caliber and, like, position of job as someone who could be a 50-year-old man in, living in Los Feliz in his big house with his kids and his car and his fucking boat or whatever it is. Like, just because I, like, have this like semi-adolescent life because I'm from here and I'm with my parents a lot and I can stop in to get food at their house or do you know what I mean?
A low overhead.
Yes, I do.
By choice, yeah.
By choice because I spend it all on non-real things. Like I like low overhead so that I can buy nice makeup and go on vacation kind of thing, which is its own financial piece. But just like asking for rates or feeling like I deserve as much as that guy in his 50s. And it's not to say that time doesn't ripen experience, but like a lot of the things that I'm actively doing for hire creatively are things that are like lifelong passions of mine that I have had a variety of experiences working in many different industries, you know? So just acknowledging that like that's just as valuable. And so just because you have a low overhead doesn't mean that you deserve low rates.
Right. Yeah. We have to undo so much socialization. And artists have an extra layer because artists have extra messaging that what you do is fun or it's a hobby or it's extra instead of it being, no, this is your work. This is your labor. This is your job.
Right. And it's like how lucky you are to do it. Of course. Like we are lucky to like.
But it's also a job. Sometimes jobs suck. Like even jobs you like, sometimes they suck or they're boring. It's labor. And how can we value all kinds of labor?
And getting real about what's the standard with different types of labor.
Right. And clear, what is the market rate of the services you're providing?
Because I think that even though I'm like discussing a bit of its lack of growth over time, like as a journalist, I've definitely made more money than a lot of journalists have because I've worked with companies that have higher rates available. But at the same time, like that's good. But it's just like, if I'm acknowledging what the state of money for journalists is, it's so bad that literally like really do other jobs too, you know? Because I can get offered to go interview a pop star day before, need to go, you know, very quick turnaround, isn't like pressurized gig. And like, they're going to want me to write, you know, 1200 words for generously like $400. It's like, I need to go there, prepare, do the interview, come home, transcribe it, be creative beyond, you know, be incredibly creative. And then like, why? So like eventually if you're doing jobs and the rate's not working for you, then it makes you feel bad. So
yeah, it's demoralizing and erodes a person's self-esteem and self-efficacy.
Right. So I know we're going to end pretty soon, but I'm curious. I know you mentioned that you are in a relationship and like, I'll just share that. I'm in a long-term relationship, I guess now, almost 3 years, but I definitely always felt that like being in love or being in a like committed relationship would like make you a worse and less productive artist in person. Big cap energy. And so not that you need to specifically address that, but just like, I don't know, like I know it must come up in your mentorship and communication sometime, like when artists or just when people are talking to you about their love life or their relationships, like is there any way to gauge like if your partner is healthily or positively contributing to your like creative practice?
Well, I think at minimum your partner shouldn't detract from it. It should be neutral to contributing. But I sort of think of like I definitely think of my relationship this way, and I think relationships can be this way. It's sort of a primary romantic relationship. It can be a battery pack that charges both people to go out into the world and be as big and amazing as they want to be and could be.
That's cute.
And so it's sort of like just assessing, is this relationship overall doing that, or is it overall draining me? Because I've definitely been in relationships that were actually just sucking me dry.
Right. And then you weren't charged up to go out.
No, like I was running on fumes.
Yeah.
And so that's something I love about my relationship is I feel like we both are sort of setting each other up to have the best possible lives.
Cute. Yeah.
And I think for artists, it's crucial to be really clear with your partner, whether or not they're also an artist, about the role of your creative life in your life and how important it is, and to tell them this is what I would like from you to help support that.
That's really nice.
And so it's like it has to start with the person identifying this is what I want and need from you, communicating it, because we get to ask for whatever we want. We won't necessarily get it, but we definitely won't get it if we don't articulate it, because no one can read our minds. which is annoying. So I wish everybody could. Yeah. It'd be great. So first it's like you have to know, what do you need? What do you want? Yes. Become aware of it. Then ask for it and say, this is what that could look like from you. Would you be willing to do this? And then accepting what the outcome is. And if a person over time is unwilling or unable to meet any of those needs, then you can sort of that's a good time to talk to an outside helper, like a therapist, right, to find out, are my needs appropriate that I'm bringing to this person? Or is this person just right, unable to give me anything? Because
we can be over-expecting or...
We might have... we might have... we might expect things from people, like from the wrong person. Like when you go to the person who you know cannot give you that thing, but you keep trying to get that thing from that person.
Right, or just trying to get like your mom's thing from your girlfriend or right, like whatever. Right,
or we have wounds and needs that we have to meet ourselves that we're trying to get met from other people. And that can be really helpful to identify. Yes,
it has been. It's like, it was actually a relaxing point in my relationship. I feel like when I realize it's mostly my work for myself.
Right.
Do you know? I'm like, right, actually, I don't know if we need to communicate this much. It's more like I should fucking keep a journal, go to therapy.
I mean, we should all first go to therapy. Yeah. Go to therapy. But for creative people, I think it's really important to identify what you want from your partner to support that.
I've never been to therapy, so I'm really... Oh,
you have a journey in front of you. Yeah. You're going to love it. It's just a class about yourself.
And chat. I know. Like, I'm surprised I didn't pre-enroll. thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I really hope that this conversation inspires some folks to have a prosperous, mentally healthy, and financially wealthy year. I wish that for everybody. Because there is no scarcity. We all deserve a lot, right? There's enough for all of us.
Yeah, and if you're in community, you can get everything you need.
So nice. Well, thank you so much for being here. I hope you come back sometime.
I would love to.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to my episode with the one and only Beth Pickens. Please follow her at Beth Pickens Consulting on Instagram, at Beth, P-I-C-K-E-N-S, Consulting. You're going to find tons of tips and tricks there, from answers to questions like, do I need to take days off, to could my current project be depressing me? And as always, follow me at TStar7. Rate and subscribe the show. Please just text it to a friend. I want to grow this community like a beautiful plant in 2020. There's such cool things happening for the show, so keep listening. We're going to have some very exciting installations and residencies popping up soon, so there might even be a chance for you to come catch us live. Until then, can't wait for next time.